Hello and welcome to Pets Plus Us, a weekly program of information and stories about the companions in our lives, our pets. I'm Mary DeFranco, your host for Pets Plus Us. Coming up this half hour, important information about ticks and Lyme disease, how to put together a cat first aid kit, and we'll learn about a study that looks at how dogs, even domesticated dogs, can threaten endangered species. And we will start with 10 things you need to know about Lyme disease in dogs. This was written by Christina Capitides from CBS News. The arrival of springtime means Lyme disease is again resurfacing as a concern on the radar screens of people across the country. So if you go for a hike or take a walk through long grass, chances are that you'll check yourself for ticks afterward. But our pets are constantly lounging and playing in conditions conducive to tick exposure. And how often do we thoroughly check them? If the answer to that question isn't every day, then experts say it's not enough. The most important thing is to stress prevention, explains Dr. Richard Goldstein, chief medical officer at New York City's Animal Medical Center. This is something we want to prevent from happening the first time. Once you're infected with these organisms, the chance is that you might be infected for life. So you just have to really go through hair by hair. Look at the paws, look at the ears, look around the muzzle, the face. If you do it every day, you're not going to get a big accumulation. Occasionally, however, a dog can pick up hundreds of ticks on a single outing, and the result can be disgusting, to say the least. Sometimes if a dog walks through a place where ticks are molting into nymphs, you might find 200 tiny ticks on your dog, explains Dr. Goldstein. That's scary when that happens, but that's not the only scary reality of Lyme that pet owners should heed. First, it's a year-round threat. It's a common misconception that ticks die in the winter. On the contrary, however, experts say that they really just hunker down and wait for the first warm day. So that makes stopping your pet's tick control medicine during the winter months a risky thing to do. There is some resistance, you know, to using medicines, he explains Dr. Joe Bloom of Harding Vet. People don't like the expense. People don't think that it's necessary in the colder months, which I think is really untrue. The magic number is 40 degrees. If the temperature is 40 degrees or higher, even for just a few hours, ticks are wide awake and hungry, looking for a meal. And we pick ticks off dogs in February all the time. Dr. Goldstein concurs. This is not a seasonal disease, says the internationally recognized Lyme expert. People used to say, well, I'll deal with it in the summer, but I'm okay in the winter. All you need is one warm day and the ticks are out. And a lot of people get infected this February, as well as dogs, because we had a lot of warm days. So year-round diligence, year-round protection for dogs is essential. Secondly, it's all across the country. Likewise, the nonchalance of the past no longer applies to Lyme's regional characteristics either. It used to be a kind of Northeast Midwest phenomenon, explains Dr. Goldstein, but when you look at the latest maps, it's all over the country. There's really almost no state without Lyme. We see quite a bit of Lyme in California and Florida, in the states that used to be relatively low in the Upper West Coast. So yeah, it's virtually everywhere, and I believe very strongly that every dog in this country should be tested annually. If you're wondering why its footprint is increasing, Dr. Goldstein says to look no farther than global warming. That has to do with the warming climate, he tells CBS News. It has to do with more deer that can transmit ticks from place to place, more mice. Mice are the main reservoir for Lyme, and the mice population has exploded over the last few years, again, possibly because of mild winters. Global warming is definitely manifesting itself in tick-borne disease in general, and we see that in humans as well as in dogs. We see diseases that exist today in areas that we just didn't have 5 and 10 years ago. Most of the tick control products we use don't repel ticks. There are many good options for flea and tick preventatives on the market. There's the Lyme vaccine. There's the more old school root of tick collars. And there are perhaps the most commonly used monthly topical and oral options. If you're one of the countless pet owners who gives their dog a chewable medication or squirts a preventive oil on their skin, you might not be surprised. You might be surprised to learn that neither of those tick control tactics actually repel the little bloodsuckers from your dog's body. Owners come to us and say, well, you know, we're using this flea and stuff, but we still see ticks on our dog, recalls Bloom, who practices veterinary medicine in a heavily wooded section of New Jersey. Most of these fleas and tick products will not actually repel the tick, will not keep the tick from walking onto your dog, and will not keep the tick from biting your dog. What they'll do is they'll kill the tick after the tick has bitten. And it turns out that's perfectly fine. If a tick bites your dog, it can transmit the bacteria, but only if it stays attached, Bloom elaborates. If the tick is killed with less than 24 hours attachment to your dog, it won't transmit the disease. If you're concerned about ticks hitching a ride into your house, though, there are some products that do physically repel ticks, a tick collar, for example, but Goldstein argues that that's not always in your family's best interest. If you're thinking about a backyard scenario, and there's the kids playing over there, and the dog's playing over there, he says, motioning to opposite sides of the office, do you really want to repel the ticks from your dog and have them climb on the kid? Because we don't have any good real tick control products for children. So maybe sucking up the ticks and killing them is not a bad thing when it's in your backyard. Next, the symptoms aren't necessarily what you'd expect. Without question, the most well-known symptom of Lyme disease in humans is the distinctive circular bullseye rash that many patients develop between a week and a month after they're bitten. That rash is great if someone recognizes that, because if they get treatment at that point, they will probably not ever get a systemic infection and won't get sick. Goldstein explains, we don't see that rash in dogs, though. That's a huge difference. In dogs, the first clinical signs that we see are the pain, fever, and lameness, which happen in people only months after the rash. That means that by the time you spot symptoms of a tick bite on your dog, he or she will likely already be infected. The other less than ideal aspect of canine Lyme symptoms is that they can easily masquerade as something else. One of the most common symptoms dogs exhibit, for example, is joint pain. So if your pet is suddenly limping, you might simply assume that they've injured their paw or overworked their knee at the park. In reality, however, they could be suffering from Lyme. One helpful pro tip that can help you differentiate the two is to take note of whether or not your pet's joint pain shifts around. If your dog is consistently lifting the same leg, he's likely just injured it. If, on the other hand, he lifts his front right leg one day and his left hind leg the next, he may have contracted Lyme. Where ticks hide? You probably know that ticks are often picked up in the woods, but they don't have to be. Goldstein says even city dogs contract Lyme, and there are telltale signs about your environment that can help you determine whether or not it poses a risk for tick-borne disease. Ticks are very sensitive to dehydration, explains Goldstein. You don't find them in, for instance, a well-cut lawn. They're always in the high grass and the bush. They'll be in areas that are shaded. The joke is that there's no ticks on the green of a golf course, only in the rough. And that's why the better golfer you are, the less chance you have of having Lyme disease. And with regard to where ticks will hide on dogs, experts say you'll usually find them in the more vascular areas where blood vessels are closest to the surface. The head, neck, the ears. They also crawl into hard-to-spot places in an attempt to hide from the dog. Adult ticks are pretty big, and dogs will see them and try to bite them off if they can. Goldstein says, so in between the toes, in the ears, around the neck, places that are hidden even from the dog are where they typically will be found. The best way to remove a tick. Upon discovering a live tick on your pet, your first instinct might be to pull it off immediately, but rather than doing so with your bare hands, experts caution that patience is the safer route. The best way to take off every tick is with a sharpened tweezer and to kind of grab them as far down by the head as you can and pull them off, explains Goldstein. People ideally should wear gloves when they're doing it if they can, or just be careful. Theoretically, if you have a cut on your finger and you squish a tick and get the blood from the tick, you could get infected with something. So be careful not to do that. Vets don't always treat Lyme disease in dogs. It may seem counterintuitive, but a Lyme diagnosis for your pet doesn't always mean that the vet is going to treat your pet with antibiotics. When we find a dog that's positive on a SNAP test for Lyme disease, then we have a conversation with the owners about whether to treat the dog or not, explains Bloom, who says he talks about Lyme with pet owners in his area 3 to 5 times a day. You know, it's unfortunately a very complicated subject, and we don't have a great understanding of it. There are not enough studies that have been done to really explain it for us. But in general, if a dog tests positive and doesn't show any clinical signs of Lyme disease, which would be specifically fever, lethargy, inappetence, and stiffness in the joints that can change from day to day, moving from one joint to another, we typically leave them alone. Lyme affects some breeds worse than others. There are a couple of notable exceptions to that rule: Labradors and Golden Retrievers. There is a deadly manifestation of Lyme disease in dogs called Lyme nephritis. It's a fatal side effect that causes the animal's kidney to fail, and researchers have a strong suspicion that Labs and Golden Retrievers are predisposed. And because of this, both vets we spoke to agree that any dogs of these two breeds who test positive for Lyme should be treated with doxycycline immediately. In dogs, treatment acts fast. If you've ever known anyone who's contracted Lyme disease, then you probably know that treatment can be a long and complicated process in humans. Thankfully, in dogs, it's much simpler. Generally, and this is, I think, a big difference between dogs and people, within a couple of days of starting treatment with doxycycline, they usually go into remission, Bloom tells CBS News. And pretty much by the second day of doxycycline, they feel so much better. They act normally, and they have no more fever. They start to eat again, and they get better. How to protect your property and your pets. On this last topic, Bloom commented that the majority of flea and tick control medicines on the market work fairly well. He, however, cautioned against using more than one of them in tandem. In my opinion, it would be overly cautious to use more than one, he says. In other words, I wouldn't use both a collar and a topical prevention, or an oral prevention and a topical. I think that's kind of too much poisoning for the dog. You can, however, combine one of the topical or oral preventatives with the Lyme vaccine. So there is a way you can further protect your pet from contracting the disease if you live in an area where deer are prevalent. If you're looking for an additional way to protect your yard, Bloom recommends having the perimeter sprayed by a pest control company. Goldstein also recommended treating the perimeter of your property, but this recommendation came in the form of a physical barrier rather than one of pesticides. If you're up against woods in your yard, a barrier of wood chips or pebbles will prevent at least the ticks from going across, explains Goldstein. They can be carried across it by an animal, but at least they won't cross a barrier like that. And that'll do it for ticks and Lyme disease. Laura Moss at Adventure Cats tells us what to include in your cat's first aid kit. You'll be more at ease on the trail if you put safety first. When you're adventuring with your kitty, it's important to always put safety first, and that means never setting foot outside without a well-stocked first aid kit for both you and your feline friend. You likely have a pretty good idea of what belongs in a first aid kit for yourself, and luckily ones designed for cats aren't too different. In fact, a good way to start assembling a first aid kit for felines is by purchasing one for people and adding a few select items to it. You can also purchase a cat-specific kit online or from your local pet store. When creating a first aid kit, first obtain a waterproof box or case and tape the following phone numbers and addresses inside. For your veterinarian, the local 24-hour emergency vet, the ASPCA Poison Control Center, and that number is 888-426-4435. It's also a good idea to program these numbers into your cell phone. Essentials for a cat first aid kit. Pet first aid book. It's a good idea to familiarize yourself with basic first aid as well as the organization of the book so that you can quickly find the information you need in the event of an emergency. Consider the Cat First Aid Book by the American Red Cross. Also, paperwork for your cat. The Humane Society suggests including proof of rabies vaccine status, copies of other important medical records, and a current photo of your pet. Absorbent gauze pads, adhesive tape, antiseptic wipes, lotion or spray, cotton balls or swabs, hydrogen peroxide, eyewash. The human version is okay to use. An ice pack, non-latex disposable gloves, a rectal thermometer, petroleum jelly to lubricate the thermometer, gauze rolls, sterile nonstick gauze pads for bandages. The Humane Society recommends self-cling bandages. This type of bandage sticks to itself, but not to fur, and is available at pet stores. Also, scissors with blunt ends and tweezers or a tick key. Your cat should be up to date on flea, tick, and heartworm treatments before heading outside. In addition to these items, your cat's first aid kit should also include anything your veterinarian has prescribed or recommended for your pet, including any medications. And remember to regularly check the supplies in your cat's first aid kit. And replace any expired items. Other items to consider: a towel and or a muzzle. If your kitty is sick or injured, you may need these items to protect yourself while you administer first aid. Also, diphenhydramine, aka Benadryl. This can be useful if your cat has allergies or is stung by an insect. However, you should include this medication only if it's approved by your veterinarian. Your vet will tell you the correct dosage to administer. If you truly want to put safety first, familiarize yourself with cat CPR. Consider taking a pet first aid course and be sure to download the American Red Cross Pet First Aid app. Also, you can watch the ASPCA's video on their website to learn how to build a pet poison prevention kit. Next, the bark side. From the conversation, the domestic dogs threaten endangered species worldwide. And this was from theconversation.com, the Conversation US is a pilot project. It was launched in October 2014. It is an independent source of news and views from the academic and research community delivered directly to the public. Their team of professional editors, it says on their website, work with university and research institute experts to unlock their knowledge for use by the wider public. And the authors are Tim Doherty, Aaron Wersing, Chris Dickman, Dale Nimmo, Ewan Ritchie, and Thomas Newsom from The Conversation. And the article is entitled The Barkside, Domestic Dogs Threaten Endangered Species Worldwide. From their research study, they write, humans and their canine companions share many close bonds. Wolves, Canis lupus, were the first animal domesticated by people sometime between 15,000 and 50,000 years ago. There are now an estimated 1 billion domestic dogs across their near global distribution. Domestic dogs include feral and free-ranging animals such as village and camp dogs, as well as those that are owned by and completely dependent on humans. Pet dogs. Our latest research reveals that the ecological paw print of domestic dogs is much greater than previously realized. Using the IUCN Red List of threatened species, we counted how many species are negatively affected by dogs, assessed the prevalence of different types of impacts, and identified regions with the greatest number of affected species. Dogs are the third most damaging mammal. We find that dogs are implicated in the extinction of at least 11 species, including the Hawaiian rail and the Tonga ground skink. Dogs are also a known or potential threat to 188 threatened species worldwide. 96 mammal, 78 bird, 22 reptile, and 3 amphibian species. This includes 30 critically endangered species, 2 of which are classed as possibly extinct. These numbers place dogs in the number 3 spot after cats and rodents as the world's most damaging invasive mammalian predators. Even though dogs have an almost global distribution that threatens species, are concentrated in certain parts of the globe. Southeast Asia, South America, Central America, and the Caribbean each contain 28 to 30 threatened species impacted by dogs. Other hotspots include Australia, Micromela Polynesia, and the remainder of Asia. Lethal and non-lethal impacts. Predation was the most commonly reported impact of dogs on wildlife. The typically omnivorous diet of dogs means they have strong potential to affect a diversity of species. For instance, dogs killed at least 19 endangered kagu, a ground-dwelling bird, in New Caledonia in 14 weeks. Threatened species with small population sizes are particularly vulnerable to such intense bouts of predation. Aside from simply killing animals, dogs can harm wildlife in other ways, such as by spreading disease, interbreeding with other canids, competing for resources such as food or shelter, and causing disturbances by chasing or harassment. For example, contact with domestic dogs increases disease risk for endangered African wild dogs in Kenya. Part of the problem is that when wild animals perceive dogs as a threat, they may change their behavior to avoid them. One study near Sydney found that dog walking in parklands and national parks reduced the abundance and species richness of birds, even when dogs were restrained on leads. None of the Red List assessments mentioned such indirect risk effects, which suggests that their frequency is likely to be much higher than reported. Friend or foe. Despite their widespread and sometimes severe impacts on biodiversity, dogs can also benefit some species and ecosystems. For example, in Australia, the closely related dingo, or the Canis dingo, can suppress populations of introduced predators such as red foxes or Vulpes vulpes, and in doing so can benefit smaller native prey. It is possible that domestic dogs could perform similar ecological roles in some situations. In some regions, dogs and their keen noses have been trained to help scientists find threatened species such as tiger quolls. Elsewhere, they are helping to flush out and control feral cats. An emerging and exciting conservation role for dogs is their growing use as guardian animals for wildlife, with the remarkable story of Oddball being the most well-known. Managing the problem. Dogs not only interact with wildlife, but they can also attack and spread disease to humans, livestock, and other domestic animals. As such, managing the problem requires looking at ecological, cultural, and social perspectives. Some of the regions with high numbers of species threatened by dogs are also hotspots for urbanization and road building, which make it easier for dogs to access the habitats of threatened species. Urban development increases food waste, which feeds higher numbers of dogs. As dogs expand into new areas, the number of species they impact is likely to grow. We can protect wildlife by integrating human health and animal welfare objectives into dog management. Vaccination and de-sexing campaigns can reduce disease and risk overpopulation problems. We should also focus on responsible dog ownership, removing dogs without owners, and reducing access to food waste. Given the close relationship between humans and dogs, community engagement should form the basis of any management program. More research is needed to get a better picture of the scale of the problem and of how dogs interact with other threats, such as habitat loss. Such actions are critically important for ensuring the conservation of wildlife threatened by dogs around the world. This article was co-authored by Dr. Al Glenn from Land Care Research New Zealand and Dr. Abhi Vanek from the Ashoka Trust for Research in Ecology and the Environment in India. And that will do it for this week. I'm your host, Mary DeFranco. I hope you enjoyed the program. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time. And don't forget, please spay and neuter your pets. It's healthy for them and the environment. Pets Plus Us is a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm your host, Mary DeFranco. If you'd like more information about this program or to hear this program again, visit our website at wxxi.org/reachout. I'd also like to invite you to share your pet story with us by writing to us at reachout@wxxi.org.